Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Bob Kinzel, co-host of Vermont Edition. Just wanted to let you know that this has been edited for brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's no secret that recycling certain materials can be difficult, and glass, which is cheap to produce but not easy to recycle, is among the hardest. The costs and logistics associated with recycling glass means it's rare that a glass bottle that goes into the recycling bin actually gets recycled into new glass containers. That gulf between perception and reality is at the heart of a story that VPR's John Dillon has been reporting on concerns from the city of Newport and a Northeast Kingdom trash hauler about the glass they paid to recycle, but they say was dumped instead. Northeast Kingdom trash hauler Pat Austin shared his frustration in early May at a state Senate Natural Resources Committee hearing on glass recycling.
The people pushing that policy, I'm not accusing them, but the people pushing that policy were making my customers think that it was being reused. And that's a problem for me.
Michelle Morris, the Waste District's Director of Outreach and Communications, says the crushed glass was being used to stabilize a road and a bank at the old landfill, a practice that was stopped more than a year ago after the district got the notice from the state about an alleged violation. She maintains the trash glass was handled correctly and that now the crushed and cleaned glass is being mixed with material from a local quarry for use in construction and road projects.
We just want to assure that Mayor Monette and the residents of Newport and anybody up in that area that we have been using this material appropriately, and we're describing how we've used it, and we recognize that everybody who uses our materials recovery facility are concerned about increasing tip fees.
John Dillon's story, by the way, is up at vpr.org, where you can listen to the whole thing and go deeper into that particular instance. But that piece of the recycling story helps to illustrate some of the issues with what happens to our waste materials, and specifically what happens to what we have all come to know as things that can be recycled when there's no market for those things. Today we're going to talk about the economic realities of recycling and composting, and we're going to start with Josh Kelly. He oversees the implementation of Vermont's Universal Recycling Law for the Department of Environmental Conservation. Josh, nice to have you back on the program.
Always great to be here.
So this is going to be sort of like duh to most people listening, but in a previous conversation on this show that we've had about recycling, my aha moment was when I realized that the idea of what's recyclable is not necessarily an object or a substance that is inherently recyclable, reusable. It's that it's only recyclable if there's some end use for that product. So there are lots of plastics, for example, that could be recycled, could be used again, could be, you know, sort of taken apart and made to be something else. But if there is no market for that, if there's no one to take that product, it is not recyclable because you can't recycle it because there's nobody to recycle it for you. And I know that that's really obvious, but it was sort of an aha moment to me because I was in the generation of kids that was told, like, reduce, reuse, recycle. Everything is going to be recyclable at some point. So can you describe the difference between what is theoretically recyclable and what is actually realistically and financially viable to recycle?
Mm-hmm. I think a good example would be plastics, as you brought up, and your milk jug number two plastic versus your black plastic, say, tray that came with
microwavable dinner.
Yeah, that's a good example. So first of all, your milk jug is one of two types of plastics, either white, opaque, or this sort of translucent opaque style. And they have different values and they have different reuse opportunities. But the black plastic tray, both could be made out of the same type of plastic, but because of that color, the recyclability of it is extremely different. So there's really no markets for black plastic generally right now. But on the other hand, your opaque translucent milk jug has value and wants to be sent to markets for other products.
Are you anthropomorphizing my milk jug now? It wants to be sent to other markets?
It does. It's screaming to be recycled.
Why? I mean, if there are things that are made with black plastic, why isn't there a market for that? Why can't you just reuse my black plastic to make more black plastic? What's so inherently valuable about my anthropomorphized milk jug?
It It's not impossible that black plastic could be recycled, but it's usually an issue of economies of scale. So if you don't have enough of it, it's not as common in the blue bin, we call it, where people separate their recyclables, whereas people buy milk and have for years. And the recyclability of milk jugs, there have been businesses that have invested in that. So there are ways to recycle
plastic. So there's a whole infrastructure.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're right. Black could be made into other black things. I have seen construction materials made into black, sort of like landscaping tubing for plastic. And that's a very common use for many plastics. But it's difficult to find markets and have enough material to support a black plastic recycling market.
Okay. So, Josh, I know you said that that little black plastic tray doesn't have as much of a use. But, you know, number or not, I want it to be recycled and I really don't feel good about throwing it away. So I'm just going to put it in my blue bin. That's okay, right?
No, it's not. And we call that wish cycling. And
that was a new term to me, wish cycling.
Yeah. And we really launched the Recycle Like You Live Here campaign in partnership with the state's two largest material recovery facilities, or MRF. And we love to call them MRF, rhymes with Smurf. So we launched the Recycle Like You Live Here campaign to get the contamination out, because we knew if recycling can be done well, then it can keep the value at these times where the markets are in sort of a downturn. So the key things that people should not be putting in their recycling bin would be, first of all, film plastics, plastic bags, and then any food in your container. If you haven't emptied it, don't recycle it. Don't put a half full thing of soda in the bottle into the recycling bin. It needs to be empty and clean for all of your containers. And then,
why?
Well, because if it has liquids, it can contaminate the paper. And that could contaminate an entire bale.
Because we have mixed recycling. Everything is thrown in together.
Yeah. And we can talk about that convenience, that it does come at a cost. And I'm sure we'll get into that in the show. And then really for some of the dangerous items like electronics and batteries, which we're seeing in many, many more things, they can cause fires and damage and injury to workers at the recycling facility. And then lastly, I think it's scrap metal that they're worried about. It does damage equipment. So while metal is recycling, put that into scrap metal or send that to a scrap metal recycling facility.
So when you talk about wish cycling, this idea that, you know, I want to be good, I want it to be recyclable, I'm going to throw my Tetra Pak in, even though I've heard that Tetra Paks aren't recyclable because it makes me feel better than throwing it away. If it comes to the point where, you know, let's say you can't clean something out, are you better off throwing something that's recyclable in the trash than putting something that is either contaminated or not recyclable in the recycling bin? You know, if you come down to that moral choice, that moment where you're looking at two bins and you're not sure, are you better off throwing it away than potentially contaminating the recycling?
Yeah, this is a great philosophical recycling question. And I would say in order to preserve the value of the vast majority of recycling, you should err on not contaminating it. So a good example might be tinfoil. Tinfoil is made out of aluminum. We're all used to using aluminum foil. We sometimes put it on a cake pan of lasagna and it comes off with cheese all over it. We've all heard aluminum is very valuable to recyclers. But with the cheese on it and the slime of the sauce, that's not going to do anybody any good. So that's where you draw the line and you throw that out. But if you have aluminum cans and containers, they absolutely want them at the MRF, just clean and empty.
Okay, but let's say I'm a hospital. You know, I have a higher standard, say, than, you know, Joe Schmo, who's recycling and putting trash away at his or her house. You know, we know that Vermont has laws. You are required to recycle. You are being required in stages to compost. So, I mean, you may feel like you're actually violating the law by putting things that either you're unsure of or you know can be recycled, but you're not able to clean them into the trash stream. And, you know, how do you parse that again if you're a commercial or large scale office or hospital where it's not just one piece of aluminum foil, it might be 1,000 pieces of aluminum foil a week? I mean, how do you do that if you're trying to, you know, go with the law?
I would say there, and we have these conversations with businesses, with residents multiple times as we discuss this change that the state is undertaking in really directing waste away from disposal. I guess the main advice is common sense. First and foremost, we have speed limit laws. We have don't text while driving laws. All of those are driving to change people's habits, and this is no different. So we would really encourage the business to look at their largest volumes of material, and this is the same process we go through when looking for compliance. We look at the largest producers first to talk with them about their waste streams and how to handle them appropriately. So we're trying to do the best good at the least cost.
So we've talked a little bit about wish cycling. We've talked a little bit about the economics. Can you talk a little bit about where things stand in terms of the market? Because we've been hearing now for a couple of years about changes that China is making. Now, China was a huge, huge market for U.S. recyclable materials. We sent a ton of recyclable plastic and other things to China. Paper is a big one. So what's happening? We can't send most, all, every, anything to China? And what does that mean for us?
I'm going to talk about it in a U.S. context and then also a Vermont context because the difference is important.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, recyclables are commodities just like corn and soy and barrels of oil, and steel and plastics and recyclable paper rise and fall with global markets. And that's why primarily China's actions have changed the game and changed the costs for the value of many traded commodities like baled cardboard, like number two milk jugs. And what they have done, and it started all the way back to 2013, people may have read about National Sword and Green Fence, these different policies that China has put in place. But in early 2017 and then up until January 2018 was when the real bans on accepting the U.S. and other countries' mixed paper and mixed plastics and recyclable material came into effect. And that has resulted in an oversupply, especially of mixed paper and some plastics, and that has dropped the price in those commodities. And for Vermont, not much of our material was being sent to China. Mixed paper was probably the main thing that might have been making it to that market. But we sell into a global marketplace. The MRFs are selling into a global marketplace. And further, if you were selling cardboard, now there's a bunch more cardboard on the market trying to find a home. So the silver lining is if you're a manufacturer making things like making box board from cardboard, you can name your price. It's a buyer's market in that way. But for the rest of us, there's costs now at the transfer station and it's more costly to haulers to haul and recycle.
So if I have a ton of cardboard, what should I be like going out on the auction market and trying to sell it to somebody?
You could. Well, it's a buyer's market for the facility to name it the lowest price they'd like because there's so much of it available. That is starting to change. We have seen over half a dozen investments in domestic remanufacturing of recycled goods, especially paper. We actually have Chinese companies buying mills in the U.S., one of which is at least in Maine and one slated to open in New York State soon.
We're talking today with Josh Kelly, who oversees the implementation of Vermont's universal recycling law for the Department of Environmental Conservation. And let's bring in Joe Fusco, Vice President for Casella Waste Systems. Casella has operations in six Northeast states, and it deals with waste and recycling from home pickup to large-scale landfill operations. Joe, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been listening to this conversation that we've been having with Josh about the economics of recycling. And I'm curious about, for you, from Casella's standpoint, how much have things been changing over the last two or three years in terms of that international global market for recyclables?
So I would characterize the recycling market as undergoing probably the most significant disruption in a generation. The value of commodities in the last two or three years has dropped probably 90%. Mixed paper, I would say, dropped 90%. I would say overall the value of commodities is down probably 60 to 65%, which is significant because we have often relied on the value of those commodities to pay for the activity of recycling.
So now what then?
So now we all have to kind of have a conversation. There's a lot of stakeholders. It's a big interwoven system, recycling. And I think all the stakeholders have to come around the table and talk about how are we going to make recycling economically sustainable. It has proven itself to be environmentally sustainable. And in order to preserve that value that it provides society, we have to work probably extra hard now to make it economically sustainable as well.
Is that something that your business can withstand? I mean, do you just then charge more on the trash hauling side of things? Because the way that we've implemented recycling laws is often you can't charge more for recycling. You can't charge more for trash hauling. So, you know, are we going to be seeing like trash hauling go way up?
I think the conversation has to include everything around the business model of recycling. I think one of the great disservices we did to recycling maybe 20 years ago was to tell everyone it was free. And it's not free. It costs money. There's capital investment. You provide that service. Sitting down and figuring out how we're going to make it economically sustainable, certainly important. Having people understand that if we really value the social and environmental benefit that it gives us, it's worth paying for. It has a value at some point. And if we're going to preserve what it does to conserve and sustain our resources globally, then it's worth having a conversation about how we're going to make that economically sustainable.
Let me make sure that we get some of our listener questions and comments in here because, you know, people do have a lot to say on the subject of recycling and trash hauling, and a lot of people have questions as well. So Melissa just sent us a little bit about an experiment that she's been working on. Melissa says, about 10 months ago, as a personal experiment, I started saving all the plastic packaging I could not recycle. I've now amassed my own little island of plastic that will have nowhere to go but the ocean. Except for using it as an object lesson for children I work with, there's nothing I can do with it. While it's served to make me even more aware of the choices I make regarding my consumption, it also points out that we actually have very little choice in how most of the things we purchase are packaged. We are suffocating ourselves and the planet. Josh Kelly, what about that? I mean, you know, we were talking earlier about, for example, black plastic packaging and how the black plastic is not actually – there's not as much of a market for it. But if you're, you know, a busy parent trying to get a dinner on the table and you're looking at the store and you're like, if my choice is black plastic or, I don't know what my other choice is, how are we trying to pressure manufacturers to do better in terms of packaging? Because, you know, again, that's a whole piece of this reuse and reduce cycle.
Yeah. This summer and into the fall, it looks like I just got word today that the governor signed the single-use plastics, single-use products bill, S-113. So we'll be having a stakeholder discussion about packaging into December when I think we were supposed to report to the legislature. So that will be an interesting conversation. And that bill actually focused on sort of three or four things, styrofoam or polystyrene as it's known, straws, plastic bags, sort of like grocery store plastic bags, and plastic stir sticks. So I think the legislature is definitely hearing the same thing, feeling the same thing, the concern about plastic. And when it's a struggle on that personal level when you make a decision about something. To the callers, to the person's comment about plastics filling the ocean, I think – we strive to ensure that trash and recyclables are well managed and when something's not recyclable, that it's responsibly disposed of. So I guess I would say that generally most of Vermont's plastic is unlikely to end up in ocean. That being said, it's still concerning that we have so many single-use products and I think the conversation will be discussing packaging in all its forms.
One person, Jake, wrote to say, why don't we just burn our waste in a power generating plant?
Yeah, Joe, you want to
talk? Yeah. People tend to think that, you know, waste energy is some sort of long-term solution. The problem with that is if you care about the renewal of resources, if you care about the life cycle of the resources that we're taking out of the planet, incineration is one and done. And it's kind of irresponsible when we can, through technology, through the evolution of recycling, create a life cycle for the materials that we're using. So,
but in the absence of a life cycle, is incineration better than, you know, putting it in a landfill or letting it go into the middle of the ocean?
I don't believe so. I believe there are issues around air quality. There are issues around what are the economics of that power being produced? I think people get lulled into a sense of, well, it's zero landfill. It's a zero landfill solution when it really isn't. It's really about what we're all trying to do in this system, and I hope Josh would agree, is create an ethic and a planet where we can address resource limits by conserving resources, renewing resources, and recapturing resources.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Mike in St. Albans emailed in to say, you know, if we're sending recyclables around the globe, how's that helping the environment and reducing carbon emissions? Glass going from Newport, Vermont to China doesn't seem to make environmental or economic sense. Cargo ships are expensive to build, operate, and maintain. Is anything being done to reduce or prevent the waste from being created in the first place? And that's what we're talking about here with that.
Yeah. None of Vermont's glass was going to China. And further, most of Vermonters' recyclables have domestic or Canadian markets. Actually, Joe could probably speak more to that. So I'd sort of say North American markets for the plastics, for the paper and the fibers. And that's what we need more of. And that shift is going to take time. There is something I think that's a benefit here in that the U.S. has lost a lot of this manufacturing, and some of that is coming back to the United States and Canada. So I think that's positive, but it's going to take time before us as consumers see the benefit of that.
We would certainly like to see more domestic markets for recyclables. That makes a lot of sense economically as well as environmentally.
Let's go to Andrew again, who's calling in from Barrie. Andrew, we'll see if you got you this time. I hear you.
Yep. Hey, Jane, how you doing?
Good.
So great. I love this topic. It's something near and dear to me. We make a lot of products. Actually, we put millions of glass bottles. We fill them with apple cider vinegar. And we sell about 99% of our stuff is organic. And what you find is that a lot of organic consumers, they really want glass packaging. And that's great. You know, we're all for that. But the downside is that, especially on transportation cost and even just environmental impact, you know, about a third of the weight of the finished product, since it's liquid, is actually glass. And so, you know, a misconception is that glass is better, when in fact, you know, if you think about all the distribution that goes along with selling a product, plastic in some cases is actually better. You know, I'm not advocating for more plastic, but I just think it's a misconception. And then one other thing, PackTech, we use them. They make a lot of handles for not only apple cider vinegar. We sell like a 2-pack of apple cider vinegar, but also they make a lot of the like carriers for like craft beer. Mm-hmm. All of those PackTech pieces are actually made from recycled plastic. So next time you pick up a Vermont craft beer, it's like kind of a thick HDP. It's like it's the number 2 plastic. That's all been made from recycled milk jugs. Hmm. So that right there is, you know, what you guys are talking about in the studio about being able to reuse those recyclable milk jugs.
Andrew, thanks for that call. Appreciate it. I appreciate hearing how you're thinking about this and that question of glass versus plastic when you try to think ethically about your own consumer choices. You know, it is a question about what about glass, because glass can in some ways, you know, it's inert. You can use it in other building materials. It's not going to contaminate the soil. On the other hand, if there's no market for glass, we're seeing a problem with what happens to the glass that you put in the recycling bin. And Joe, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that, because, again, without a market, you can't really recycle things.
So if you're thinking about just the blue bin, I don't think you're thinking big
enough. I'm not thinking
big
enough.
So the issue is really illustrates how this is a global intertwined system where there are a lot of stakeholders and a lot of moving parts. And so the conversation really is about how do we as a society consume things? How do we package things? How do we design products and services? And what is our larger culture saying about how we use resources? And so having those conversations and having other people brought into that conversation, I think producer responsibility is a huge issue going forward in the future. Are they producing products and packaging them in ways that are recyclable, that use as few resources as possible, is a more important conversation, particularly from a public policy standpoint, particularly from an economic culture standpoint, that really then impacts the blue bin.
Well, yes, I hear what you're saying and I agree with you. On the other hand, if consumers are driving the choices, if Andrew's making organic, you know, apple cider vinegar, and his customers won't buy it if it's in a recyclable plastic container because they believe, because of the culture that we live in, they believe the better choice would be glass. And not only that, but if you're trying as a manufacturer to do the right thing and there's a global market for one thing for a couple of years and you've created your entire manufacturing process around that idea and then the winds shift and suddenly your manufacturing process is not in favor, I mean – It goes sort of up and down the whole channel.
Welcome to the complexity of life on Earth. And it really just illustrates the point that there's more than one factor at play in any given time. There's more than one area's behaviors. It's more than just consumer behavior. It's more than just manufacturer's behavior. It's more than just policy behavior. It's more than just people who are skilled at recycling and their behavior. It all has to work together. And I think sometimes we avoid some of those difficult conversations and large scale change. It takes patience and a lot of hard work.
Let me go to Janet, who's calling in from Fletcher. Hi, Janet. You're on the air.
Yes, I actually have several comments. The first is I think transportation of the recyclables is an issue. So I don't understand why each region, and this goes all over the world, doesn't have their own systems and their own plants that can reuse and repurpose recyclables.
Janet, let's put that to Josh Kelly. So, you know, what about this idea? You both have said it would be great, and it's starting to happen, that there's more domestic production of recyclable materials, that they're taking in recyclables and actually, you know, going through the whole process in the U.S. and Canada. Janet's saying, why not do this regionally? Why not get our Northeast states together, for example, and do that all the way from the, you know, top to bottom?
There were some costs to sending stuff and relying on China. But it's not as simple as that. So for one, to manufacture at scale, to keep your equipment running 24/7, which is the most efficient and the most successful business model, you need throughput. And Vermont doesn't produce a lot of materials. Basically, it's by population and economic activity. And so what you have is, if you're remaking bottles from plastic, which occasionally there's more and more recycled content, more commitments to that going into bottles in the future. The plant where they make those bottles may be down south. It might be in Georgia or one of the southern states. So to get material down there, it actually is more efficient to send it down there rather than having a bottle plant that couldn't probably compete. I mean, it's basically the factors of the open market that play a role here. I will say, though, there are several good examples of domestic, even Vermont, facilities that recycle right now and make things out of our recyclables. So one is the Missisquoi Paper Mill up in Sheldon Springs. I think it's owned by Rock 10, and they take in fibers, mainly mixed paper, from transfer stations. So people are source separating there, and they make a fiber board out of it. So things that your pasta box is made out of come from that. And then there's another one in Putney Paper down in the Brattleboro region, which is exploring taking more recycled fiber. I think they make tissue at that place. Maybe Joe knows more.
Yes, and also just over our borders in Glens Falls, there's a mill where paper is taken and recycled.
Joe, we have some criticism for you. Tyler in Wheelock says, it cannot be understated how quickly zero-sort recycling killed the recycling industry. It convinced people everything was recyclable and it didn't matter how dirty the recyclables were. Casella has hurt recycling with their zero-waste initiatives, and they're petitioning the legislature to change Act 148, the Universal Recycling Law. Tyler says it's time to kick Casella out of the State House and hold the waste management industry accountable. Now, you know, when you look at any business, you know, if you have a business that relies on people to either throw things away or recycle them or both to certain degrees, I mean, you have a business that's based on that kind of model. So how do you be a good player in trying to reduce waste when your business model is built on waste?
Well, two things. First of all, zero sort did not destroy recycling. Zero sort, wherever.
And just to remind people, zero sort is you can throw everything in one bin. You don't have to separate your paper from your plastic from your glass.
Like anything else, it has an upside and a downside. And the upside was, in places where we initially rolled out zero sort, recycling rates doubled. But it comes with a cost where you start to see some of the things that people shouldn't throw away that Josh referred to earlier wind up in that bin. Okay, so it's a trade-off in some ways, but in many ways it really made recycling as easy as possible, which is a great goal to have, a terrific goal to have. I'll say this secondly, I'll share this. The fastest growing part of our business is a division within our business that works with manufacturers and institutions like hospitals and colleges and universities to eliminate waste entirely in their processes. So we take an approach corporate-wide that we are here to help the world kind of confront this challenge of resource limits and to use our expertise, whether it's in recycling or helping people eliminate the concept of waste in their factories and so forth, is something that we've built our business model on.
So this is not just a feel-good initiative for you. You're saying that it actually, in a way, to stay sustainable as we progress, part of the business model of Casella now is in sort of doing that consulting process of trying to reduce waste. So that's another way that you're generating income if the waste stream goes down.
Here's what we believe. We will not be in business in 20 or 30 years if our business model is built solely on this idea that society consumes things. We have to help our customers. We have to help the communities we serve, the society we serve, understand how we're going to solve this problem of limited resources.
So, Josh Kelly, when you look in your crystal ball, I mean, Joe Fusco already said this is the biggest disruption in the recycling industry in a generation. I mean, it's only been a couple generations that we've really been focusing on recycling. But, are we seeing a crisis here, at least in Vermont, when it comes to our recycling facilities, when it comes to what our business models are going to be, when it comes to our waste districts and how they're operating? Is there a path forward that you see for this future where there's more of this being done domestically or some other type of model?
I'd characterize it as there are pressures in, like any industry, in the waste and recycling industry, and we're in a pressure point right now. I don't know if I'd call it a crisis, but we're definitely in a pressure point on recycling. And I want to – and the farthest crystal ball is we're also staring down a pressure point on disposal. In the Northeast, there are states that have produced more waste, Massachusetts and Connecticut, that have more capacity to pay for that. So we're also in a place where the future of disposal capacity is also going to be an issue. So I think the bottom line for listeners is that the recycling and the guidance we learned in kindergarten, reduce, reuse, recycle, still holds true. There are jobs and companies depending on people to continue recycling each and every day across the United States and North America, as well as globally. And reducing is where you save yourself the most money and save the most resources. I have a reusable water bottle. That's the first place I start with not consuming a plastic bottle each time I want to drink something. So that's where we really need to focus our energies, as we always should have. And instead of thinking, well, we're recycling, isn't that the right thing? There are still it's still a benefit. It's still the right thing to do.
So Joe Fusco, when I said, are we in a crisis? Is there a future? You were shaking your head vehemently. And I don't know whether you're meaning, no, we're not in a crisis, or yes, there is a future.
There is a future. I think the crisis is in places outside of Vermont where they don't have the ethic and the long history of having this kind of philosophical moral thing that we talked about earlier of understanding how important it is to recycle, reuse, reduce, renew resources, conserve resources. There are towns, cities, states that are just dropping off the edge and giving up because recycling has become so difficult economically. I don't think that's the case here in Vermont. There are challenges, as Josh said, and I just think that we have an opportunity really to fix it once and for all, strengthen it for the future, and make it economically and environmentally sustainable.
Well, we didn't get into composting today, but that's okay because, we do a daily show. So there's always time to talk composting another day. So we will bring it back, that composting topic, because I know many people still have questions about composting, both around state rules, but also how do I do it? Where do I do it? What do I do? What can I compost? So we'll talk composting another day. Josh Kelly oversees the implementation of Vermont's Universal Recycling Law for the Department of Environmental Conservation. Joe Fusco is a vice president for Casella Waste Systems. Thanks very much to both of you for being with us today. Appreciate it.
It's always nice to be asked somewhere when you're in the garbage business.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Jane.